Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Bringing Design Closer. My name is Jerry Scullion and I'm a service designer and founder of This Is HCD and CEO of thisisdoing.com, where we provide live online design and innovation classes, providing training for service designers, design researchers, product managers, user experience designers, content designers, and much, much more. Today in the show, we have Errol Fox, someone I recently connected with, not on Twitter, but within the This Is HCD Slack channel. Errol describes himself as a human rights-centered and humanitarian designer and is one of those designers that makes many of us quite enviable with their skills. They can work with organizations in pretty much any area of design, from workshop facilitation through to UX research, prototyping. They're pretty much an all-rounder. But we speak about diversity in design, but not at a superficial level. We try to get a little bit deeper into areas around speaking up within organizations and feeling empowered to do so. I love speaking with Errol. They're a wonderful person, and I'm so excited to share this episode with you. Let's jump in. Errol Fox, a very warm welcome to Bringing Design Closer. How are you?
I am good. Thank you for chatting with me today.
No worries. I'm excited to speak with you. Errol, let's kick off. Let's start talking a little bit about you. Tell us how you describe what you do to your friends and family.
Oh, well, my friends and family don't really get much of an intro, but for those that are interested, I say I am a designer of things. I don't tend to give myself much of a title anymore. I kind of have had many titles over the years, but I am currently doing most of my hours at an organization called the Open Food Network. So I work there as their sort of lead designer, which means that I do anything and everything design-wise. So product, management, writing issues, doing all the things. I also do lots of other things outside of that. So I help maintain a community called the Open Source Design Community. I am part of Sustaining UX and Design in Open Source Working Group. I do stuff at OpenIDO London. I do other things at another group called the Human Rights Centered Design Group. And then I do a bit of speaking and a bit of other things on the side when I get time and don't need to sleep. So yeah. That is largely what I do.
You are busy. I follow you on Twitter and there's always something going on. It's like something big is happening every week in Errol's life. At the moment, it seems. I know you're speaking at a conference recently.
Yeah, I just finished doing a really interesting workshop, actually, with a really amazing designer called Abigail Makolo. I met her in Nigeria at the beginning of this year when she was giving a talk about how she got started in open source design. And you know, one of those moments where you meet another designer and you're like, I have to do something with you. I have to collaborate. We just have to. So I grabbed her and said, let's do a workshop together. So we did. Yeah, we did a 2.75-hour workshop for very intense maintainer developers in open source talking about design related things.
Wow.
So yeah, it was good. I found that doing online workshops, though, especially with like a developer audience, there is a challenge with having them just have open discussion about different things. So, yeah.
I don't think that's just the developer community. I think it's
true.
Generally online, it's kind of hard to build an open kind of dialogue across a number of people at the same time.
Mm.
But hopefully it'll get a little bit better, because I do a lot of work online and it's, you know, I'm noticing a lot more people are kind of coming to the trough and sort of drinking the water, shall we say. But I want to chat to you more today, because we've been working on this episode probably about 2 months. We've spoken about 2 months ago, and you sent me a note there, and I wanted to read it out as a prologue for this conversation. I'm going to read it out first. So it goes, "We're getting into tricky and complicated territory where there can be virtue signaling, cultural and community assumptions, access level being accurate representations of inclusion, and something that sounds very boo-hoo, poor white person. From my perspective, the more that you want to be a designer, the battles for inclusion, representation and justice in design for underrepresented majorities, the more you can distance yourself from your community, that there isn't yet, and yet you're not part of these communities that you want to do right by. You kind of float in between in a space that perhaps is inhibited by a handful of other people that are slowly becoming more happy to move away from the herd, but in that there is vulnerability." Tell us what you were thinking when you wrote that.
Yeah, this is the challenge. So when we are talking about diversity and inclusion and then accessibility and justice within the design profession or within your design work, and I've been doing this for about 5 years. Like, I first started becoming really interested in how representation of people was happening in my design work about 5 years ago, when I actually started to work in startups as opposed to commercial big companies. And I started to experience the freedom of being able to position more, like, what I thought at the time was edgier ideas, which were just about really diversity and inclusion ideas. And as the 5 years have progressed and I've slowly become more involved in things to do with human rights and things to do with humanitarian efforts and working for an organization that was based in Kenya and organizations that are based globally or doing global kind of work for communities that don't necessarily have the same kind of access to resources as I have, and doing design for those communities, the more I've been experiencing this feeling of wanting to do right by those communities, be involved in those communities, learn more so that I can be a better designer and better design for those communities, because I am hired to do that. But the more that you embed yourself and learn and genuinely have this passion to be inclusive and to be thinking in a design justice kind of way, the more you're aligning yourself with those communities, those underrepresented majorities, but you'll never be part of them. You don't experience the same kind of discrimination that they will face. You can understand it objectively, you can even empathize to a great degree, but you won't be part of them, even though they might welcome you like into their communities. That there's always going to be that, I'm not quite part of this community. But then you also distance yourself from your community of origin, and that is white, reasonably well-off people in my case.
Yeah, it is a little bit of a case of trying to encapsulate something that's entirely complex. And there's a case there that it can be easily trivialized by just saying that we've included these people and we spent an hour with them and we did these exercises. And these are the main pains and gains that we've identified. Let's go fix them. There is a little bit of painting by numbers there to try and solve some seriously complex issues.
Yeah, definitely. I have experienced a lot of different projects where we have, even in companies that are based, say, in Kenya or based in sort of communities that they want to serve, where we've tried to take some kind of participatory design approach, or, you know, maybe we are trying to include the communities that we want to design for as much as possible. And yet what you're doing is often constrained by all kinds of different resources, as well as your own access and feelings. So even if you are able to hire somebody that is part of the community, pay them like the same that you would be paid, fully include them in that process of participatory work or liberatory work, then you still are filtering it through your experience as a kind of slight outsider designer. And I had a lot of inner turmoil and outer turmoil actually as well. With my design colleagues about whether or not we should really be designing for these communities and how we should be designing for these communities. And that kind of going back to what we were saying at first, it's that boohoo, boohoo yeah. white designer. Oh, you know, you've got such complex feelings about being paid to really interesting work. Like the work is fascinating and interesting and wonderful in a way that you feel, you know, you feel grateful that you're able to work on these really complicated problems. But who are you as a privileged person that gets to go back to your place with running water, with a democratic system that sort of works reasonably, to relative comfort? You don't have to live with the idea of these things, the reality of these things that the communities experience. So,
yeah. There is a point to that because, say, a lot of my experience has been in Australia, and the whole fact that if you're working in spaces of marginalized people in society, you can sort of reiterate, or I don't know what the right way to phrase this is, but like basically repeat centuries old kind of behaviors of the white person trying to solve things for the Indigenous peoples of Australia. Just having the conversation with them initially is what I found to be really empowering, and saying, listen, look, what can I do to help? And I'm here, I'm interested, and you tell me what I can do to help make this better, if you're open to it. And it's not really a case of me saying, I was really aware of this. I became really aware of it in design when I was in Australia. I was like, hi, I've got a problem, and I'm sure you have the problem too, and I'm here to try and work with you to try and solve it. And they're like, who are you? You just come into our community. Like, really? Look at you. And I'm like, for people who don't know what I look like, I'm bald, I'm white, and I'm man. So I'm like the antithesis of what they would imagine to be coming into that community. And it was eye-opening for me. And I think we're pretty much speaking about the same thing there. Like, have you given much thought around what we can do to make this a little bit more palatable, a little bit easier? Because I'm aware that what we're talking about here is an awareness that design fundamentally is flawed. And the mindset of a designer, I like to think, is relatively coming from a place of good, and it's not set in stone. It's something there that we can reshape and reform into something that's going to be a lot more inclusive. Have you given much thought what that might look like?
Yeah, and it's definitely changed over the years. So originally it used to be things like do as much as you can to present multiple options. Like, so I was thinking in a very visual design kind of way, where early on I would sneakily try and put in the more diverse options, or I would be out there doing the data mining to try and prove that a certain direction should be taken for the UX of a product, or how we include different diverse language and things like that. I would spend a lot of time building up case for that. And while I still think that that is really important to do, I still think it's a great process to understand where your hunches are coming from. It's generally good practice to be able to do that. And I think that it's also really good to know how you would go about the argument process with evidence, should you come up against arguments. And I cannot say with confidence that you wouldn't come across some kind of resistance or pushback to more inclusive and more accessible and more justice-oriented design ideas. But I really do see the future as the designers within the industry taking a real strong stance to just say, this is how we do things. We do this by default. There is actually no other option to be less inclusive or less accessible or less justice orientated. And again, we've said the word vulnerability quite a lot, but with that comes from vulnerability. It's what you're saying is it's this way or the highway. It's being inclusive of low income populations in different countries that don't have a device that is modern within the last 5 years, and they have internet speeds of this quality, or nothing. You don't get anything. And it feels a bit zero sum, but I really do think that that is how we will convince the more capitalist side of culture, the side of the industry at large, to consider this as the path forward, like the path forward rather than a path forward, and make it less of an optional extra, less of a feature request or an improvement on. If we just get the basics right, we'll do the version of our software tool, or we'll do the version of our campaign that meets the needs of the people that we really understand well, the white middle class men that we know. Mm. And maybe we'll think about the other people that would actually really benefit from whatever we're trying to design more. We'll think about them afterwards. I really want us to move towards a path where that is never gets discussed at the outset, that it's just a given.
So where do the problems lie in terms of the process? Is it going right back to research, or is it the teams being formed that aren't representative of the people that they're designing for, or is it everything? What needs to change, and where are the main problems living?
I think it might be part of how we are as design individuals as well as teams. So I wasn't always like this. I wasn't always as interested in the things that I'm interested in and the sort of diversity of the diversity topic as well, until I started to really enjoy the process of talking to other people about what is going on in their lives, the process of better understanding the things that happen over here in this space versus this other space that I maybe know a little bit better. And then also having conversations within the design teams and the wider teams that I'm working with on design problems about those kinds of problems. And I think it kind of comes back to that, something that I think is an essential design skill of compassionate curiosity and just genuinely wanting to learn more about what is going on in the world. So maybe the root problem is of that is I don't see a lot of structures where designers are able to do that in their companies. So the idea that you could spend valuable design time having a conversation and learning something new about a community to be inclusive of them is something that I, even now in the very open and progressive places that I do work, they still sort of say, oh, do you really need to spend time doing that? Like, what kind of are you going to gain from having that conversation? And, you know, there are still the quiet sighs that happen in work conversations when you're like, but what if a farmer in Uganda needs to do this, this, this because of the community and the structures in there? I mean, that is actually a recent example that I had with my current workmates, because one of the things I learned just by having conversations with Ugandans is that there is a social media tax, or like a certain taxes that got put onto certain services. So I was like, well, how is this tax going to impact how you want to use our tool? And they were like, oh, actually, that's a really great question. I'd really love to answer that for you so that you can better consider that within how you build your tool. And I wouldn't have known that if I hadn't been able to have the conversation over, I think, lunch at one point with a previous Ugandan colleague. So yeah, better diversity of teams is absolutely some way to go towards that. But then we get into complex territory around how to make sure that team members across the globe are being cared for well. Mm-hmm. So when I am here as a designer being innately curious about how history is taught in Kenya, or how Uganda plays this intermediary role between Kenya and Tanzania in political issues, or interested in all these different things, like what pressure am I putting on my teammates and colleagues who actually have stuff to do that isn't servicing my curiosity? Yeah.
So a large part of it is down to the formation of teams to make sure that what you're designing or who you're designing for is represented in the teams that are building it and designing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that would definitely help, but I get cautious and I get worried about this because I think that it's a very easy answer to say, oh, we just need more diverse teams, we just need more diverse hiring, without necessarily thinking about, okay, what does somebody that's based in Nigeria need from us as a company? or deserve from us as a company that we're hiring them for? Or
yeah,
what is the right thing to do there? Because I've again had conversations with folks both based in Nigeria looking for remote opportunities that are international, and as an example, and companies based here in the UK that notice that there is obviously talent in places like Nigeria that they want to hire. Oh, yeah, massive. It even sort of always feels really humorous to me that that statement needs to be said out loud. Like, there is talent in X country. It's becoming less of a surprise.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's less of a surprise to people now, but there still are conversations that are had about this. Like, there is an agency I was talking to at one point. They've got a Nigerian developer on the team, and they were tackling with some issues around their clients knowing that they have a Nigerian on their team and wanting to reduce the price of what they are getting from that agency based off of that. And then that agency was having this conversation with me about, oh, how do we just say that they're just a team member and it doesn't matter that they're based here versus over here? And I said, well, you know, you're not necessarily going to convert that client right away to thinking that they can't, you know, save money by having a quote unquote cheaper member of staff through your agency immediately. But what you can do is have a conversation with your Nigerian colleague about the best way that that can be served from their point of view. You know, actually, do they want, what do they want in that circumstance? Have a conversation about how you can actually push that forward and maybe publish it openly. Hey, other agencies, we had this conversation. We decided to not necessarily try and solve it from our management European white perspective, but we decided to really engage with the wider Nigerian community to kind of better understand how that could be solved from the person that is negatively or discriminated against perspective.
Yeah. So one of the things we were speaking about before was the fear about speaking about these things and receiving the wrath of communities who may feel that things weren't being said the correct way. But from my experience and from my perspective on things, one of the most important things we can do as a community is speak about them and shine a light on these things. And I was speaking to Dr. Lucretia Berry, who the episode should be out probably by the time you're listening to this one, recently. And I explained that there was a certain amount of fear from my own perspective about saying the wrong thing and coming across as saying something that's socially incorrect. And Lucretia made a really great point that, like, you know, that's coming from a place of fear, that we're taught that fear. And it's okay, as long as we coming from a place of purity and a place of intent, to talk about these things. Because if you don't talk about them and we, you know, kind of keep them compressed in a chest within an organization, they're never going to get the light and the energy and ultimately the money and energy that's required to try and tackle them. So for people out there listening, like, I'd love people to talk more around these issues, because even myself, sometimes it's hard to bring these topics around and into what I would call like a normal conversation about addressing them and giving them the weight that they truly deserve. So what's your take on that? Like, what do you say to people who are a little bit more fearful about approaching these topics?
Yeah, this is huge. And one of the key things in the talk that I give and have been giving for a number of years now, which is about diversity and design and beyond, really, is to be getting comfortable with the idea of being uncomfortable. Like, the feelings of discomfort, the feelings of fear are things that the more that you understand them, the more that you work with them personally, the less that they will feel like the end of the world, in a good way of kind of phrasing the enormity of those feelings sometimes. And I think that good intent is always a really, really good thing to be coming from a place of. I personally always come from a place of good intent until proven wrong. Most people that are marginalized in some way do that. It is very rare that they haven't been taught how to come from a place of assume good intent until you have good evidence or good understanding to do that. I think that there are a number of ways that you can tackle this, really. I think there's a less extroverted way to tackle it, which is about reading widely and consuming content of varied different kinds of sources. And if you're struggling to find sources, then you can start with one source and then branch out from that source ad infinitum.
Yeah.
And the second thing to do is, once you feel more comfortable with those kinds of knowledge bases and those kinds of conversations, is start to have those kinds of conversations within communities that you feel relatively safe in. So communities where you are share the same sort of quote unquote demographics. They might be other white people if you want to start thinking about how to have conversations about race. They might be other heterosexual people or people that aren't LGBTQ. If you want to start talking about those kinds of issues, it might be people that are cisgendered if you want to start talking specifically about trans issues. And then thinking about how you might take that into a forum where other people of that marginalization are present. So one of the things that I do in my diversity talk, I actually stole this from the Stonewall conference, which is you enter that space and you enter that talk willing to compassionately correct and be compassionately corrected. So I have noticed every time that I give this talk, the one about diversity and design, which tends to focus more on experiences of my own LGBTQ identity with and my sort of invisible disability identity, I will inevitably get some kind of question, which is a very confrontational, in objective terms, a very sensitive topic. Often I get the question, which is, you don't look trans, which is it's never an easy question to hear, but I understand why it's asked. And the more that it's asked to me, the more that I'm happy to and prepared to answer it. And the more that I understand what the need for that question being asked and then being answered is. And I don't know whether I enjoy having that question proposed to me, but I enjoy the idea that at some point somebody will be able to have some information of which to ask a better question to somebody else. And I think I've definitely had some experiences where people have seen some of the content of the talk where I talk about UI design, and I talk a lot about like how we can design better data capture if we need to capture data about people, and how to do that compassionately for things like ethnicity and race, and how to do it for gender diversity and expression. And one of my most happy moments is when somebody actually saw a second talk by myself and came up to me afterwards and said, after your diversity talk, I went and had this conversation about the suffix, the Mr., Miss, Mrs., and MX, which is the gender neutral term. And we had a really great conversation within the development team and the product team and the wider team about why we even need that. And, you know, it was complicated and it was uncomfortable, but it was so, so useful. And thank you for that. So, yeah, I think that there is a need to embrace to some extent that fear. And the more comfortable and privileged that you assume or think that you are, the better positioned you are to deal with that fear. And I think that one of the things to be careful of around that fear is to try and do your own work around how safe you feel in general. And if you feel relatively safe as a person existing in general life, then you will have some level of fear when tackling these topics that you're unknown about, that are unknown to you. But you will at least have the safety that you're not going to be harmed if you start talking about these topics. So a good example to say is, if there was a group of design peers that you had access to, Jerry, perhaps they were of different kinds of race, but you had a reasonable idea that they were not part of the LGBTQ community, and you went to them and said, hey, let's think about having a conversation about how to be more inclusive of people that are transgender or part of the LGBTQ community. There, you're coming from a relative point of safety as what I'm assuming as a heterosexual white male part of that community. Whereas a person like myself going into that community, even though it's actually quite easy to hide your sexuality unless you're very open about it online like I am, and your gender identity, I'm not entering that space from an assumption that I will not be attacked. So there's kind of, you know, it's a good idea to really think about, okay, what conversations am I approaching from a point of safety versus a point of being unsafe? So that's a good thing to consider.
Yeah. But approaching those conversations, like, are there things that we can do to reduce the likelihood of the, I don't want to say backlash, but, you know, improve the safety aspect in terms of like leading up to those conversations? So I'm just thinking for people who are in their organizations at the moment and they want to start the conversation off, what are the steps that they can do to, like, it's easy for me to say, everyone today, this is going to be a safe room, and which we all know is a load of CRAP, but because it's not just a case of saying it to make it, it's a case of like designing that and making sure that people are feel brave enough to raise their voice and be heard.
Yeah, this is like another buzzword for our conversation is tricky. It's another tricky topic, because one community's level of safety for a conversation is not another community's level of safety versus individual safety. So yeah, it's a tricky one. The one thing that I'm certain of, and conversations that I've had with organizations around this topic, is an endless source of frustration for me, is when these companies come up to me and they say, we really want to start having more conversations about diversity and inclusion in how we work, both in a sort of organizational way, but also how we do our work as well, like, so our design work or our development work. We want to have more conversations about that. And I sort of start talking about the things that I've experienced, and I start kind of explaining those things and also anecdotes from other stories that I've heard. And they sort of stop me and go, whoa, can we just, you know, have it a little bit more solutions focused, or can we make sure that there's a positive outcome to this? And I see a lot of, it is shocking to kind of have that, but there is a real desire for those conversations to finish on a positive note. And I think one of the first things that you can do is have that understanding and that framing of, you might not come out of this conversation feeling 100% great, like you've got anywhere near a solution, that it feels positive. And actually, it might do good to have a whole session which is about focusing on just those really nasty, awful things that happen, so that you can sit with those feelings and you can understand those feelings from a group perspective. I would love it if more conversations about inclusion and diversity and discrimination and how to change tools and software and all the things that we work on, how to change those things to mitigate and stop those awful things from happening, weren't always tinged with this, but we need to find the solution. Sometimes the people that are treated awfully and marginalized, they need that space to say, here's all just this awful stuff, and I'm not going to sit here or I'm not going to be part of the solution part just yet, because it's such an impactful experience to be kind of marginalized and discriminated against in large and small ways, day to day, hour to hour, week to week. You know, I've had to tell a number of different companies, just sometimes I just don't have the energy to fathom this kind of positivity that you're looking for to feel better. So that's one thing that I would say, expectations wise. About creating a safe space, I think that practicing apologizing, practicing your own way of doing apologies, practicing your own way of receiving information that may or may not be kind of in the moment feelings based. We all have a tendency to say things that are ill-informed or based off of learned behaviors. I certainly have many, many learned behaviors. It took me, how long did it take me? Quite a long time to remove the vocabulary of guys from my just general speech patterns. You know, I trained really, really hard to just remove that from collective group reference. And even as a person that is affected by that statement, and what it took was several conversations with myself, several conversations with others, a lot of just practicing. And also when I still do those kinds of things out in the wild, remembering to go, oh, hang on, did that wrong. Here's the correction. Move along.
Yeah, it's a complex thing. But like, as you were saying earlier on, or as I was saying earlier on, it's something that I'm nurturing my children to think more about in terms of the pronoun choice, to become more inclusive by default. And the story I was telling, for anyone who follows me on Twitter in particular, like, my little girl's 3.5 and I walk them to take her, and there's the lollipop lady, which is what society calls them. But I'm like, hey, there's the lollipop person. And it's kind of come part of their natural vocabulary at the moment. But about a month ago in Ireland, as it's coming into autumn, it's raining a little bit more. And on a Saturday, I said, hey, let's make some gingerbread men. And her hand goes up. He goes, Daddy, I think you mean gingerbread people. And I'm like, yeah. And you mean, I was just so proud, like, at that moment where, you know, it's, they get it, Freya gets it. Like, it was a wonderful moment for me as a parent. And it's hope for the future is what I'm looking at.
Yeah, definitely. I look to the globalization of the younger generations with immense hope and immense positivity that there will be the energy to carry these kinds of things forward. But from a, going back to sort of like a design and business perspective, I just can't get past this. If you're not here with this moment and working on these things, you're just going to get left behind. And if that means for profit-making companies, if you're interested in profit, it means that you're going to make less profit. One of the stories that I reference is when I was working for a well-known student accommodation company, we would go and do check-in when we were allowed to move around freely in the world. So we would go and check in students. And I remember the online service of booking and paying for your accommodation was very non-diverse. It was very much, you know, you have the male and female option. And also it was hilarious at the time because I was trying to push for this. They wanted to put males in flats with males and females in flats with females. And the reasoning for that was so obscure and very kind of Victorian British, because I was like, well, why can't people choose who they want to live with? And there was this whole, oh, you know, but what if, you know, they get distracted if they're, you know, in flats with, you know, opposite genders. And I was just like, what do you, I mean, who cares? One, that students want to have a good time with other students. But also two, I was absolutely gobsmacked. They didn't think women that identified as women and couldn't distract each other. It's quite fairly common knowledge that that happens, and vice versa. So it just seemed laughable to me. But when we went and did the check-ins and actually were at the properties chatting with a lot of the users, you know, the people that used our service, I would regularly see people that were of whatever gender kind of visibly walking hand in hand, and definitely some couples or people looked to me that they were presenting as two female people in a relationship.
Yeah.
And I was just like, well, if you're not doing that work and signaling that, hey, you're inclusive of this, or you know that this happens, then it just, to me, it just seems like you're going to become an antique pretty quickly and just be laughable. So, yeah.
It doesn't take much in those circumstances. Errol, coming towards the end of the episode, if people want to reach out to you and get in touch, follow you, now's the time to say it. Forever hold your peace. What's the best way for them to make contact?
The best way to make contact with me is via the Twitters, which is at Errol Does Design. And Errol is spelled E-R-I-O-L.
Yeah, it's a great name. I love it.
Thanks.
I'll throw a link to that in the show notes, everyone. And I'll also throw a link to your website as well for people to check out some more of your work. I really enjoyed speaking with you today. And look, honestly, thank you so much for your time. I know you take time out of your day to do these things. So I really appreciate it. It was great speaking with you.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you so much.
So there you have it. That's all for this episode of Bringing Design Closer. If you like this episode, feel free to visit thisishcd.com, where you can access our back catalogue of over 100 episodes, with episodes related to service design, product management, design research, and much, much more. Now, if you're interested in design and innovation training, feel free to check out our business, thisisdoing.com, where you can join online classrooms and learn from the world's best design and innovation leaders. Join the This Is HCD newsletter, where you'll receive updates from the network. And also, if you're interested, apply to join the Slack community on thisishcd.com. Stay safe, and until next time, take care.